You are Locked On Suns, your daily Phoenix Suns podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Back here on Locked On Suns, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. This is the last time you will hear from me before Thanksgiving, so I wanted to wish all of those who celebrate a fantastic holiday. We are not slowing down, though, here. We have a great week of shows ahead. Last night, I recorded with Gerald Bourget. That went up this morning, Tuesday morning, for all of you guys. I'm recording this Tuesday afternoon. Just got done recording with Michael Pina, the guest of today's show. He writes incredible stuff for 538, as well as GQ, which is about as impressive of a balance as you can imagine. I think that's a cool little back and forth there. I think he has a good perspective on and off the court stuff, so we get into a lot of that with him. Before that, though, I wanted to tell you guys a little bit about my thoughts on this Kelly Oubre. I don't even know. situation, we'll call it. Because it's been what a lot of people are talking about in Suns world. I know Dave King wrote about it at Brightside. Greg Esposito was tweeting about it a little bit. Both of those guys from the Solar Panel Show, Mike V. Hill from the Timeline Podcast, tweeted about it a little bit. It's been on everybody's minds on local radio every time I've turned that on. So I think it kind of is an intersection of a lot of things that Suns fans have had to deal with, I guess you could say, or a lot of different perspectives within this organization that have clashed over the years since this rebuild began. And I think, you know, I'll read you some of the quotes here in case you did not hear them, and then I'll give you my thoughts, because I do want to give my perspective here, and I think a podcast is the right place to do that. So first, he was asked, Kelly, during an appearance on the local sports station in San Francisco, about playing for Joe Lacob, the Warriors' hotshot rich owner, and a guy who is known to put his money where his mouth is. Even the mere presence of Kelly Oubre, I think, indicates that, because he comes with a pretty hefty luxury tax bill. His salary is an exponential increase in their luxury tax bill, and so that's an indication. He responded by saying, "You just hit the nail on the head. I can play for an owner in Golden State," he's talking about, "somebody who actually cares about the organization and not just the perception of the organization on the media end of it. It's all about the foundation for me. You have a beautiful foundation and can build a beautiful future." In a separate interview with David Aldridge over at The Athletic, somebody who covered Kelly early on in his playing career on TV, and Aldridge now is the editor-in-chief of The Athletic's Washington Bureau, and obviously that's where Kelly played before he came to Phoenix. Here is the question. David Aldridge asked, "What was this last year plus in Phoenix like for you?" Pretty open-ended question. And Kelly responded this way: "It was up and down, of course. It was a lot of uncertainty for me as a player. Obviously, I had a great year statistic-wise, but I had a lot of just misunderstandings of who I was as a competitor, because I was trying to lead a group or try my best to be a vocal leader on a group that didn't really understand how to make it to that next step. Obviously, me being around the same age as everybody, it was just kind of like, you know, bruh." I think that emphasis is mine, but reading it, I think that's how he said it. And Kelly continued, "It was kind of a lot of pushback. I was trying to be understood and heard, that I just want to win and help you guys win," talking about the Suns. "But it was me going out there and just doing it and just having that fire and that passion, which I can now just seamlessly fit in a group who already understands that," talking about Golden State, "and bringing what I have to bring to the table. Phoenix was great, but I got a lot of stuff out of the mud. I got a lot of my points. I got it out of the mud. I didn't get a lot of plays called for me or anything, but that's just how I've been playing my whole career." Kelly went on to explain in multiple different interviews. He also did a TV interview in the Bay Area, as well as that radio interview that I previously read from, where he explained that he just did not feel mentally ready to perform at a high level in the bubble in 5-on-5 basketball, in part because COVID interrupted his progression. That is the public story. I don't have much more information on that. What I will say is that it was fishy from the start, because of the way that it played out. That was, I think, about the end of my time here on Locked On Suns in the summer before I stepped away when we were talking about that. Kelly said one thing, which was that he was not sure. He said that to Cam Cox in an NBC Channel 12 interview. He said it to me in a Forbes story that I wrote about his fashion launch. But then James Jones and Robert Sarver both said different things on local radio. Okay, so there was clearly a difference of opinion on Kelly's status in the bubble. You can understand he's going into a contract season this year, knew that he would probably be a tradable piece should the Suns look to upgrade their roster, and did not want to jeopardize it. We saw that with Bradley Beal. We saw that with Davis Bertans on other teams that were on the outside of the playoff picture looking in. I don't have much issue with what Kelly did in the bubble. I think it's perfectly understandable. I don't think you should give him any more grief than you gave Bradley Beal. Keep the energy that you gave Beal and Bertans, two guys who did it for different reasons seemingly, but were on teams unlikely to make the playoffs and made their adjustments. LaMarcus Aldridge went ahead and got surgery during the pandemic during the hiatus so that he would not be available. Obviously, that timing could have been different if he wanted to perform for his team in the bubble. That did not happen. Okay, so Kelly's by no means the only player who did this. He's also by no means the only player who, on his way out of Phoenix, had a little bit to say about management or about ownership. I don't think Kelly crossed a line. I don't think anybody else seems to think that he crossed a line. But when you see Eric Bledsoe, Goran Dragic, Markieff and Marcus Morris, Trevor Ariza, the list goes on. I'm sure that TJ Warren. There are numerous players who, for one reason or another, did not feel appreciated, did not feel respected, and did not feel aligned with management and ownership. Now, we're talking two separate regimes here, so I do think James Jones has done an impressive job shoring that up. I think James Jones is going to be the reason, predominantly, that changes, if it changes, and I think we're headed there. That doesn't mean that it has changed, and it doesn't mean that Kelly didn't feel the same type of way that a lot of players have felt in the past. Kelly, for all of his curious perspectives on things and the tendency he does have to see things through his own lens, which is I'm not faulting him. That's just how he is, but based on being traded and being I think what happened in Washington in terms of the culture falling apart there colored his perspective. I think the way that his contract negotiations went, all that made him feel like he's kind of in it for himself right now. And that played out because he got traded again. So I don't think that's incorrect. But returning to what I was saying, Kelly is going to see it as, because of those contract negotiations and everything, he is going to have a problem with the way that he was treated. But I also don't think that it's separate from the other things that similar players in similar circumstances have said. We know this is an organization that has been challenged for how it's treated its players. Okay? The leadership comment to David Aldridge at The Athletic, I'm very confused why people are reading so much into that. I think we all know who the leaders on that team were. I think, you know, Ricky, Aaron Baines, and Devin Booker were the leaders in that group. I think Kelly, in his own way, was an on-court sort of a, not, maybe I wouldn't say leader, but a sort of like the arrow on the compass for the team in terms of his energy, the spark he played with, the sort of heart that he played with, I think was infectious. I think it sort of ingrained itself in this team's mindset from day one, from when he got traded, even before Rubio and Baines were acquired. So I think, you know, he's a guy finding his way as a young player trying to be a leader on a team. And the fact that he didn't feel respected through the contract stuff and the trade situation probably is why he doesn't feel like that was necessarily received. Maybe we hear more in due time. I doubt we will. This is not the type of thing that gets aired out very often. I think Kelly wanted to say his piece because he's a little bit frustrated with how things played out, but I don't imagine this will linger. So this is probably all we're going to have. But a lot of people are sort of bringing Devin Booker into this, which I do not understand. And I'm personally not going to involve myself in any Kardashian family rumors or whatever. Maybe that plays a bigger part than we realize. It would not surprise me, but I don't feel like it's my place to speak on that considering we have absolutely no info there. If more comes out, sure, I'll integrate it into my coverage of this situation, but I just don't see that right now. So what we're left with is a guy who was under-respected and has felt that way for the majority of his career. I think that's a way that he energizes himself. I think that's a way he plays. That's the way he sees the game. That's the way he sees the league and has right reason to do so. He's now been traded twice and has not gotten a long-term contract yet in the NBA. So that's how he seems to want to power himself. And on the internal side within the organization, he is saying things that every single person has said. Not every single person, but everybody on the list that I'm talking about. We've heard all of these similar stories just about every time a major player leaves the franchise, they have negative things to say. What this shows me is that the Suns are not out from underneath of that yet. They have more work to do, and whatever was going wrong in the past is still there. It's not fixed just because of one season in which they played better, or one bubble, or one hiring of a great coach, or one, you know, solid trade to get Chris Paul and a guy who wanted to be here at an all-star Hall of Fame level. None of that means that the problems at the underneath are not there anymore. Did the Suns need to get rid of Kelly Oubre on their own side? Maybe they felt that way. Maybe they didn't think that it was tenable anymore. They didn't want a guy who was a distraction there. But the idea that Kelly was sort of out of line or out of place here, I don't see that at all. I really don't. We'll bring on Michael Pina in the second segment of today's show. But before that, I want to tell you about the sponsor of the show, which is Built Bar, the best tasting protein bar ever. As I told you guys, ordered my own pack finally here, took advantage of the offer that I tell you guys about so much, and I could not be more excited. Built Bar is delicious, packed with protein, not too heavy on the calories, and they just unveiled 6 new delicious flavors. We have apple crisp, we have cherry barcia, but best of all, this week only for Black Friday, if you're dreaming of a white Christmas beginning Thanksgiving Day at 5 o'clock p.m., Built Bar is introducing the all-new white chocolate bar while supplies last. That is white chocolate, cookies and cream, white chocolate, salted caramel, and 2 free candy cane brownie bars with every item purchased. That sounds delicious. Like I've told you guys before, all of them are covered in chocolate and they're always so yummy. And white chocolate is even better, especially for the holiday season. So go to Built Bar right now, builtbar.com that is, and get 25% off for Black Friday. Plus, don't forget to use the promo code LOCKED to get an extra little bit off. Cyber Monday, if you're dreaming of a white Christmas, it continues. White chocolate continues with white chocolate cherry sundae and white chocolate coconut deluxe, 2 additional new flavors just for the holiday season. And you get that same 2 free candy cane brownie bars with every item purchased while supplies last. And those are not just candy, guys. That's still a protein bar. 150 calories, 17 grams of protein, only 7 grams of sugar. And during that Cyber Monday deal, 25% off all products. You can try that white chocolate goodness or go back to your favorite. Plus, you will receive 1 free advent calendar with every purchase, which has 12 Built Bites in it and 12 months of savings. So to take advantage of all of that, go to builtbar.com and get 25% off for Black Friday. Plus, do not forget to use the promo code LOCKED to get an extra little bit off. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, tons of deals by Built Bar. Please take advantage. They sound delicious. They sound holiday, perfect for the holiday season. And best of all, they are that extra little bit of power you need in your day. All right, we are here with Michael Pina. You can find his work at GQ at 538. He co-hosts the Open Floor podcast and wrote an incredible profile of Jaylen Brown. I think the bar is, and I mean this as no insult to you, but when you get a subject like Jaylen Brown, Michael, it's kind of hard to not at least start it with an interesting perspective. But I mean, this one is even better than I think anything I've read about Jaylen, so it's a testament to your writing as well. Tell me what is it just like to talk to this guy about all of the various things that he's interested in? Because he's somebody who we know ever since he was at Berkeley is
thoughtful, introspective, obviously very hardworking dude. So just give us a sense of the time you spent with him and the kind of what was the main thing you came away thinking?
Yeah, so I mean, honestly, if I could have profiled one NBA player coming out of the bubble experience, it would have been Jaylen Brown. He, as you said, even before, you know, the past 4, 5, 6 months was, you know, had established himself as very, I guess, different in a lot of ways, particularly off the court and in his sensibilities from other NBA players. And he's been dedicated to a lot of off-court ventures regarding, you know, education reform and social activism and just his own personal interests, like him wanting to intern with NASA, that sort of thing. Like, he's just a super fascinating individual. And so, you know, you can take a profile of him in a lot of different directions. And the one that, you know, I think interested me personally the most was his outspokenness on, you know, anti-racism measures that needed to happen by himself, players with humongous platforms, and the NBA as an enterprise. And so that's primarily what we discussed. You know, you could also go into the fact that he's, you know, one of the burgeoning young all-star caliber talents in a league that really covets exactly what he is as a two-way player on the wing. You could go into, you know, he has a lot of eccentricities that I didn't really get into in the piece because they would have been off tone, I think, with what we were particularly discussing. And, it, you know, I had a word count. And so you're kind of limited there, and you can go super sprawling with him. And it would just be like a 5,000 word opus about just this super, super intriguing individual. But for me, again, I just wanted to try to tighten it up as much as possible and talk to him about you know, the protest that he had and try to get as many behind the scenes details of that and what motivated it and what his experience was like in the bubble from the perspective of someone who really felt compelled to educate people about anti-racism. So that's kind of, I don't know if I answered your question, but that's kind of just my mentality when I was getting into the project.
Well, and I think that's the fact that it, even the answer went in so many different directions, I think speaks to what is so fascinating about Jaylen as a person. And I will have you know that Katie let us know in the Dime Uproxx Slack that some of what got cut, and that inspired me to now find my rising sign. So I can attribute that to you and your work here. But Jaylen, to me, I think what sticks out from, you know, understanding that mostly Suns fans are going to be listening to this is some of what he said regarding what kind of comes after this with this stuff. Because, you know, I don't think any Suns were necessarily on the forefront from a league perspective the way that Jaylen was, being part of the Players Association or somebody like Chris Paul was or any of the Milwaukee Bucks players who led the strike. But you know, they were having these conversations in their own way. Monty Williams was very vocal locally and, you know, was showing them movies and just trying to lead conversations, just a little different for a younger team. But, you know, with Paul coming here, I think that's going to not necessarily go away. And Monty is somebody who I think, you know, he was pretty open about the fact that during the bubble and during what happened this summer, it was a realization on his part that it wasn't really something he was okay with within himself to not speak up. And, you know, it just wasn't a part of his mentality as it pertained to being a coach before, but it seems like it will be going forward. So you kind of asked Jaylen, like, what do you think comes next here with regard to the league really centering these issues? And I think he referred to it as it needs to be a lifestyle. How optimistic are you from your conversations with him and obviously just as somebody who covers the league that that's a possibility going forward?
That's a very interesting borderline loaded question.
well, then let's like keep it to what the vibe you got from him, because he has more control over it than you or I do, right?
Sure.
So what do you think from what he said? Do you think he's optimistic about it?
It's so funny you use that word optimism, because I specifically asked him, are you optimistic? And he gave this really eloquent answer that it was actually cut from my first draft, about why he is optimistic. I think more he was speaking broadly about society and the depressing nature of the cyclicalness of racism in this country, and subjugation, and just how it feels very endless. But he was optimistic from everything that he's witnessed over the past few months, in terms of just being a member of a younger generation that has really embraced the need to speak out and not hide. And when he speaks about his colleagues and everyone else in the NBA, even players who did not necessarily vocalize their outrage, I think they were very emotionally impacted by everything that was going on, be it inside the bubble or outside of the bubble. And he really wants players to speak out. He also understands how difficult it can be and the work that it takes to educate yourself. And, when you say things like this, like, for example, when he just started a Zoom press conference by monologuing on the third verse of the Star Spangled Banner and the history of it and why it was problematic. Like, a lot of people, I'm sure, who were listening to that had no idea or were just uneducated on the background there. And, you know, it takes reading, it takes having conversations, you have to have like a commitment and a dedication to wanting to know and learn, and that's like a first step towards change. And so I think Jalen is optimistic that players will, particularly the younger ones, will accept that challenge and be part of change. And as someone who is involved in the union as heavily as he is, I had a really wonderful conversation with Michelle Roberts about him. That was probably my favorite interview besides the one I did with Jalen for the story. He will potentially, I would say he's on track to be the president one day of the Players Association. And when that happens, his influence will be humongous on the league. And we can only, he was mum about what he had in mind about what he would, what his quote unquote agenda would be when that day came. But I'm excited to see it if it does come.
Me too. I think, you look, like, I cover the WNBA so intensively that this stuff is central to what they do. And I don't think that there's anything particular about the NBA that makes it so that they could be an exception to that, based on the fact that so many of the demographics are the same in the league and we know the perspectives are pretty similar. It's going to take people like Brown to be the ones to kind of knock the first domino down, I think, and he seems ready and eager to do that. So, I would say from a Phoenix perspective too, it's going to be just fascinating, and part of the reason I wanted to talk about this with you is that Paul coming to this franchise is going to be, just a spotlight in every sense of the word that they haven't had in a long time. And what does he do for the other players? What does he do for the community and the fan base and the organization top to bottom? And I think this will be part of it, because this is a conversation in the league and Paul runs the Players Association. So, is the player lead in the Players Association. So I just think it's going to be kind of the next chapter here this season, 2020-21 and beyond, is going to be, I think it has a real potential to be the first part of something different, or we could look back on it as a missed opportunity. And I think your story got into a lot of that in a way that I hope others will follow suit with, because if we learned anything from what these guys were saying, it was, let's not have it end the minute that we leave Orlando. In a lot of ways, it seems to have done that. You know, obviously we have transactions in free agency, so I'm not going to be naive about it. I know why the tension has been elsewhere, but let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. We will hit what the Suns did this offseason and some of what the team might look like in the next segment with Michael. We'll be back right after this. All right. Suns are basically wrapped up here with their free agency additions. Jay Crowder, obviously, Chris Paul, who we just discussed in the last segment, and some really nice value signings, I thought, in terms of Langston Galloway and Etuan Moore coming on minimum contracts, just guys who will fill out a bench. Damian Jones is sort of whatever. Retaining Dario Saric on the contract they did was pretty strong, I thought, for both sides. You know, they got him. They took advantage of the fact that there was no market, but got a player who I think will contribute. What did you make of kind of the way, after understanding that Paul was going to be the point guard for this team, Michael, what did you make of the way the Suns went about filling out the rest of the roster?
I'm a huge fan of everything that they did, to be honest with you. I mean, I guess it's really difficult to talk about this without just starting off with a quick, like, statement about, like, or assessment of the Chris Paul trade, which I thought was really great for Phoenix in a lot of ways. I've seen some criticism of it that I just don't agree with, and I think the on-court fit is brilliant. I don't think that this should be viewed through the lens of as a gamble. I don't really understand that line of thinking. I think the opportunity cost, like here, like getting someone like Paul, I think that's something that the Phoenix Suns are not accustomed to, getting a player like that who was a borderline, not even a borderline. I think he was a legitimate MVP candidate last. I mean, he was never going to win, but he probably should have ended up on more ballots than he did. So that's just it's a transformational piece, assuming that he doesn't totally fall off a cliff, which I don't think that he will. So you get him at the point guard slot, and then, you know, I really loved the Jay Crowder signing in particular.
Okay. Tell me why.
You get someone who, is a, you know, coming out of the bubble, was a legitimate rotation player on a team that went to the finals. I think everyone knows or should know what his limitations are by now, and what type of player he is. He's a streaky three-point shooter who is not the most laterally quick on the perimeter. Playing him at the four, though, with Ayton at the five, he has some stretch to him. And when he does get hot and it's sustained, like, he just transforms an offense as he did in Miami. So I feel like having someone out there with the type of gravity that Crowder presents, the type of, you know, it's not necessarily or technically championship experience, but getting another person in there who knows what it takes to, you know, coming from Miami and the culture there that is notorious, like, I think that that is infusing that type of character into a locker room that is young alongside Paul is really good for this team. And he's someone who will elevate the internal expectations of the young players who are there. And so that's just why I like that. And I understand that, you know, 3 years, 30 mil, I don't think that that is like an untradeable contract also for after this season or whatever. I mean, I know, understand why Miami, it was too rich for Miami's blood because they need to keep everything clean for a potential Giannis signing. That's understandable.
Yeah, but he's only 30, you know? So I agree. I think they can trade that in a couple years if they
need to. So, I mean, that's the first one that I just really, really liked. You mentioned Saric, and you know, that's fine. I think, like, one of the interesting things about that signing is, as someone who is just like, I'm okay with Saric as a player. I'm okay with that money, with the years on it. I think it's interesting that, you know, they project him to be their backup five. I guess he was their backup five in the bubble, and it was nice. But I guess, like, can you tell me a little bit more about their draft decision. That's the one that, you know, really had me scratching my head. And at the same time, I was kind of just like, maybe I shouldn't be doubting James Jones, who, you know, drafts Cam Johnson a year ago, and Cam is looking like a pretty good, solid NBA player. But at the same time, I'm like, if this guy, if you've targeted this player at 10, like, why isn't your strategy to like trade back and get him and pick up another asset? Like, that's something I just don't understand about their calculus. But what can you tell me about, like, why they would draft this guy?
I think, I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable question. I think at the end of the day, I just don't think James Jones, for better or worse, hasn't really seemed to bother with the value proposition of trading back or maximizing every square inch of an asset that way. You know, we saw it last summer with the way that he had just kind of dumped TJ Warren in order to create cap space for Ricky Rubio, and the way that he did the same basically with Josh Jackson and used DeAnthony Melton as part of that to get off of Jackson to create cap space, and then bought out Kyle Korver and took back Austin Rivers in the Kelly Oubre trade and just bought him out really as a favor. I think that's sort of what this is. It's just they liked their guy, and it didn't, I mean, even the trade last year with Cam Johnson, it was obviously would have been even crazier if they took him at six. I don't know if they would have even done that. Maybe they had somebody else in mind at six, but they go back to 11 and all they get is Šarić. Like, we saw trade ups that you think what the Hawks did last year to go get DeAndre Hunter. They gave up a whole bunch to go to four, and the Suns only got Šarić to give Minnesota jumping from 11 to six. So I just think most of his track record shows that type of like aggressive, like vicious value play is not really how he's going to operate. And then with the player, like, I think they seem to think he's a four, or at least can grow into being a four. Everybody who has watched him more extensively than even I have, and I pay attention to the draft a decent amount, I'm not optimistic, but then even people who know more than me are also not optimistic. So, you know, drafting a backup five at number 10 is a really rough thing if that's what he ends up being, but maybe they just truly didn't like anybody else. I don't know. I mean, but that's where I wanted to go with this is, you said Šarić is sort of like fine. I think I agree for the most part. He's probably a rotation player in the NBA. Remains to be seen if he's a guy who would be like on the floor in a finals game, but fine for where they are and fine for the way they want to play. With that said, though, like, he probably is going to be playing a lot at the backup five. They might have to have Jalen Smith come on the floor as a rookie for more minutes than I would prefer if I was them. Do you think, though, that the perimeter, I'm mostly talking about the defense, because the offense seems like it's going to be really good. The defense, though, do you think that there's a chance that the perimeter defense with Paul, with Mikal Bridges, with Jay Crowder, with Javon Carter, do you think that can add up to enough to kind of offset the questions they're going to have on the interior defensive rotation?
I mean, all those players that you mentioned, you know, Bridges, I assume will be even more sound going forward as a defender and one of the better 3-and-D. I really hate that term 3-and-D, so I apologize for using it, but it just kind of stumbled out of my brain. But like a really versatile wing defender who can guard multiple positions and guard multiple positions competently and also hit threes and do some other stuff. You know, I imagine he'll be even more sound next season. I imagine that Paul, who remains, you know, I think it's an interesting question to wonder who's a better defender at this point, CP or Ricky Rubio, if there will be any drop off there. I don't think so. And then I like Carter as well. And Crowder is what he is, I already mentioned. But like, I think the answer about their defense ultimately comes down to DeAndre Ayton and just his evolution on that side of the ball. And I thought that he made strides last season. I think we've talked about this before on the pod, but a lot of the on and off numbers are pretty good, or were pretty good in a small sample last season, and lineups that are what you want if you're a Suns fan. I don't know how he'll translate to, you know, a playoff series and what his impact would be in that. But just for the regular season, I think that this defense can be like, there's no reason why this can't be league average, maybe top 12. Like, I don't think that that's out of the question at all.
It seems to me like they might be setting themselves up to switch a little bit more, which, similar to Booker playing like a James Harden point guard role, is something we've been saying about Ayton since the moment he got drafted and hasn't happened and probably isn't necessarily the way that the Suns want to like have as their base defensive scheme. But I do think they have some more flexibility to do that when you bring in Crowder and Paul, because I think you're right. As a team defender, I think Paul and Rubio are pretty even. I think Paul probably has, even though he's older, just from watching him in the playoffs the past couple of years and stuff, I think he probably has a little more left in the tank as an on-ball point guard defender when he really wants to be one. Rubio, I don't know if it was playing with Gobert for so long and developing a little bit of bad habits or just not having it left to put in that much effort, but he really wasn't much of a guy who's going to fight through screens or anything at this point. He played off the ball defensively quite a bit more than I expected last year. So Paul can do that. And then you have Crowder and obviously Bridges. Booker at least has the size. I mean, he's not going to be really great defensively in any matchup, but he at least has size where you can switch him around. And then Ayton can do that. So do you think there's maybe a little bit more potential with the Paul and Crowder additions to just be a little more versatile defensively than they were last year when they were, you know, rolling out lineups with Rubio and Baines and like Cam Johnson all on the floor at the same time?
Yeah, for sure. I do think there's versatility here. Losing Oubre a little bit hurts that, but I don't think too much. You know, he has athleticism as a wing defender, but more athleticism than someone like Jay Crowder. But like, you know, I at the same time think that they can be more versatile, but I think one of their strengths could be being a little bit more traditional and Ayton developing and improving as just a drop defender with CP really being a pest and Carter being a pest fighting over screens. And I do wonder how CP will influence Booker on that end and really get him to buy in on a possession to possession basis. Depending on what type of player he's defending, if he's chasing guys, I don't think that this is really going to be his role too much, but chasing guys off ball through a thicket of screens, really fighting over screens on ball, knowing when to duck under, shuffling his feet. Like I wonder just how much Paul will influence Booker. I know that they have this shared agency and good relationship right now. These things are subject to change historically after you spend some time playing with CP. So right now it's kind of a honeymoon period. But, you know, if Booker, you know, theoretically he should have more energy, will not have the ball in his hands as much as he has in the previous seasons. But yeah, I think to answer your question, they have options and Monty Williams is a wonderful coach and it'll be really interesting to see just how much they buy in on a night to night basis.
Yeah, I forgot you were such a Monty guy. We appreciate that. I think he's a good coach too. I think he's going to be probably a little bit of insulation for the Paul. The downsides we've seen from the way some guys don't get along with Paul just because of their relationship from New Orleans. I think that hopefully, at least, you know, in theory, you would hope that that helps the transition a little bit. But you talked about earlier what you don't necessarily see why it's being discussed as a risk. To me, the one way I see it from that perspective is exactly what you were just discussing, which is that this is a team that sort of was stacking up the tower of culture a little bit piece by piece. And they introduced like a big boulder to that that can either sort of like sit on top of it and make everything hold together or crush it. And, you know, I don't know if it gets to that point. I mean, I don't think they're going to be like competing for a championship like the Clippers and Rockets were, which, you know, just sort of creates even more pressure for a team than where the Suns are. It didn't seem to really make much of a negative impact on the Thunder last year. And to your point with Booker potentially bringing more out of him defensively, he's also going to have more energy to do that. But then you've also seen like something went well for Dennis Schroeder last year, right? Like he played a much different and more kind of efficient and valuable style of basketball than he ever has. A lot worse than Devin Booker, but we do see plenty of positive examples as well, and I think Ayton could be one too from a big man perspective. He really loved playing with Rubio, and Ayton's been a guy forever who has really like yearned for players and coaches and just external forces to pull more out of him, even opponents. Like throughout his rookie year, it was this ongoing thing of how much like he would just kind of praise the guy who just took it to him on the court. And it was weird, but I actually think he's just that type of a person where he kind of needs that stimulus from the outside, and Paul will bring it. So it's going to be a matter of if he can handle that or not. But I think defensively, that versatility will help. I think having somebody at the point of attack like Paul, who I think is better than Rubio defensively, will be big for them. And they just have depth. I mean, that's going to be not as important for a championship team, but for this team, it's going to be important. And I think for this team, it's, you know, with kind of protecting Paul from whatever this season is going to end up looking like, with not a long layoff and a condensed season and potentially sicknesses and all the rest, I think having that depth will be helpful. Cool. I think we covered everything. Anything else from your perspective about the offseason you wanted to hit on? I mean, do you think this is a playoff team? Let's end there. Do you see this as like a pretty secure team in the playoff chase this year?
I mean, that's where I wanted to ask you the exact same question, like what you envision for this team as the ceiling. Like for me, I like to be bold this time of year. Well, I guess not normally this time of year, but this time of year on the NBA calendar. And I'm normally optimistic about teams that I was bullish on with their what decisions they made in the offseason. So like to me, Phoenix, like I can conceivably see like a 4-5 seed in the playoffs, honestly. And yeah. I'm not saying that that's definitely going to happen or that should be the expectation, but I can see it if everything goes right, if everybody stays healthy, if, you know, Booker is just like a clear all-star to the point where it's like this guy should be start if like Harden gets traded to the Eastern Conference and it's just like, okay, Devin Booker is the starter, is like an all-star starter, obviously, then mm-hmm. Yeah, this team is really scary. And in a playoff series, who knows, with having CP and having Booker, I mean, their offensive ceiling is just super, super high for me. So yeah, I mean, it's like, Are they on the same level as a Denver or a Utah? I think it's a little bit of a hot take to say it's possible, but I think that it's possible.
I think it's possible too. I mean, I saw somebody, there was a little thing going around of people doing like the high and low end in the standings for every Western Conference team, just sort of like the floor and ceiling. And they had the ceiling as the 3 seed for the Suns. I don't expect that to happen by any means. I think that would be crazy. But I mean, you just went through and, you know, if we know they're worse than the Lakers and Clippers, right? But other than that, I don't think it's a positive that they're worse than every other team. So I guess that leaves you as like, if every possible thing goes right, maybe they're a 3 seed. I don't think so. I would be, we talked yesterday on the show about, you know, just avoiding the play-in game would be a success for them, getting to the 6th seed. And I think that should be like sort of the median. That's where you should be shooting for this season. If you do better, obviously you're not going to complain. If you do worse, you're kind of in a rough spot because then you're really, you know, putting a lot of pressure on these first year playoff guys to win that play-in game and then go to the playoffs and then try to do something. So we'll see. I agree with you though. I think they're firmly in the mix, and I think the offense, like you said, has a chance to be really special. I think it could be top 10 pretty smoothly. I don't think they don't need to get really lucky even for that to happen. I think with Paul and Booker, you're in a really good spot, and they've added so much shooting. Ayton provides that middle anchor, the downhill threat. Hopefully he gets a little more creation to his game. So yeah, they're on the right track. I'm glad you're optimistic as well. It makes me feel like I'm not just talking myself into it, having watched terrible basketball for so long. But you can find his work over at GQ and at 538, as well as the Open Floor podcast and this show from time to time. Thanks for coming on, Michael.
Of course, man. Thanks for having me.